Wonderful. Welcome, everyone. We are really delighted this week to be hosting from just down the road our colleague, Professor Ayan Zarakol. Professor Zarakol is Professor of International Relations at the University of Cambridge. That's why she's here. She is a leading scholar with work at the intersections of historical sociology and relations, focusing on East-West relations in the international system, the history and future of world orders, conceptualizations of modernity and sovereignty, rising and declining powers, and Turkish politics in a comparative perspective. Her writing has been published in every major IR journal you can think of, from the American Political Science Review, the National Organization, which she also fits, International Affairs, International Theory, International Studies, Quarterly, European Journal of International Relations, Review of International Studies. I don't think there's one left. Ayşe is also the author of two major monographs, After Defeat, How the East Loved to Live with the West, which was published in 2007, and the more recent, Before the West, The Rise and Fall of Eastern World Orders, which came out in 2020. These are much garlanded works, which have received, again, prizes from almost every major IR profession association you can think of, from the Social Science History Association to the International Studies Association, to the American Political Science Association, and major grants from, I think, probably every grant-writing body you can think of. For our purposes today, as we think about the world we live in, the disorder of our times, as Ayşe calls it, we might be tempted to feel that there has been no such experience before of this all-encompassing polycrisis. But Professor Zarakol asks us to think about this. Is it really unprecedented, the times we're living in? Or are there experiences in history that might help us understand where we are at better? We can't wait to find out, Ayşe. The floor is yours. We start.
Thank you. It's my great pleasure to be here. My first time giving a talk at the center. Thank you so much for the invitation. And also, this talk is one that I've given into different settings and audiences, but never in Cambridge. So I'm also excited about that. Let me get started. So, the 21st century has been, especially if you're in the West, has been a tumultuous one, right? We opened the century with 9/11, followed by the war on terror, followed by the global financial crisis, followed by the Arab Spring, and the violence in the wake of that, refugee crisis, Brexit, election of Trump and other similar politicians, the positions of power, COVID, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, October 7th, and its aftermath, right? It's one thing after another. So when you think about what we've been through, it seems like we lived through disorderly times. That's why, there are a lot of people now, especially in my field in international relations, who are trying to think about, not just in international relations, but in all, I think, cognate fields, they're trying to make sense of what is going on. Now, if you turn to traditional IR scholarship about how do we explain, why is it one crisis after another, there is actually an answer that this is nothing new, that there is always, every now and then, that there are periods of uncertainty and disorder and conflict, and these are periods of power transition or rebalancing, right? And as you go from, as you change great powers, or you go from, unipolarity to bipolarity, so somebody like Mearsheimer, who's, you may have come across him, he's a well-known IR realist who opines a lot about Russia and Ukraine, so he's in the news. So somebody like Mearsheimer would say this is just a period of transition and it's all great power stuff. Everything else kind of is downwind from that rebalancing. Or again, you know, there's the idea of international relations, the notion of a thucydides trap. China is approaching United States as a great power. It's and this particular theory, again, power transition theory, predicts that as the you know as to as the rising power gets close to a hegemon, there will be volatility. That this is a, this will be a conflict prone time. So these are. This is the traditional IR answer, and obviously, you know, it comes from a particular reading of history, and it looks especially, you know, to the 20th century to, you know, draw these lessons. The proper analog is, I think, the interwar years, especially. I'll get back to that in a second. So let's consider that one camp. That's you know, we are in disorderly times, but it's as precedented. It's nothing different. Then I'll put in another camp historians. I'm not sure how international law thinks about it, but historians like Adam Tooze, let's make him the stand-in for this camp, say that we are living through unprecedented times. I mean, historians in general like to say everything is unprecedented. They don't like to draw lessons from the past at all, unlike, you know, IR scholars who look at history. So that is generally true. But Toons and others have this, you know, more nuanced argument that, you know, what it's a time of polycrisis. It's, you know, multiple things going at the same time. And, you know, they magnify, compound the challenges. And that's why, you know, our times are unprecedented, you know, climate change and all the other things combining with political volatility and, you know, economic factors. And that's why we are in unprecedented times. So, you know, who's right? I know, obviously, you know, we can pick our camps, but I thought, maybe we can split the notes that the times, and that's what I'm going to argue in this talk, the times that we're living in are not unprecedented necessarily. It depends on how we set up the comparison, right? And this is also a talk about and a project about how we think about historical analogies. But I think there is something too easy about turning only to the 20th century for analogies. And that argument comes out of this project that I've been overseeing, which is supported by the British Academy, called Pathways from Disorder to Order. It's a multi-year project that is meant to bring primarily IR scholars and historians together to look at certain periods. And those periods are, I'll tell you, the 17th century, 19th century, and 20th century. And that's not because only these periods have this disorder, or, you know, these are periods, especially the 19th century and the 20th century, are clouded, at least in international relations historiography, as periods of, as, you know, as centuries that had disorder from which order emerged. So obviously the 20th century, I suspect international law has a similar kind of take on this, you know, the interwar years then gives rise to the post-war or Cold War order or liberal international order. It's, you know, and then the 19th century international relations, in specifically as this understanding in the beginning of Napoleonic Wars and so on, from that comes, you know, concert of Europe and a kind of order. The 17th century, the typical IR take is about Westphalia, from which all order emerges. It's like, you know, ground zero. And I disagree with that, but that's another, you know, from disorder to order period. And yeah, so the project has brought together in a series of workshops historians, the IR scholars, as I've said, and we've had a lot of conversations, and quickly it became apparent that historians have a very different historiography, very different take on what was happening in these centuries. But it's been, you know, a series of productive conversations, which I'm happy to talk about. But coming back to, you know, what I'm going to argue today, and this is, I think, going to be my first publication from this project, maybe intended for a place like International Affairs, which is health policy, health, you know, academic kind of journal, about, you know, what analogies do we use, how helpful they are. And if I said the 20th century is a very popular analogy for our current period of disorder in international relations, but I think in generally in public discourse, you see a lot, you know, very easy, like do a very simple Google search, and there are lots of headlines talking about Obari in the interwar years. What kind of lessons can we learn from interwar years? You know, in that comparison, the period from the end of the Cold War to the present, it's like the interwar years. And we are now at the tail end of it. There will be a lot of conflict, hopefully not another world war, but something like that. From that will emerge the next order, right? That's kind of the expectation. So that's one analogy that's popular. A second analogy that's increasingly more popular, especially since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but also since Trump became president, is the 19th century imperial analogy, because, you know, Russia, of course, has brought back like land war to Europe, and Trump, especially in the first months of his presidency, was constantly talking about annexing Greenland and Canada and all that. So this territorial kind of expansionist model, I think to a lot of people, looks like 19th century imperial competition. And of course, possibly you could put China into the mix with Taiwan. And then we started seeing in the last few years, especially, that we are in a back to the 19th century. We're in a 19th century moment of imperial competition, which is something slightly different from a, you know, a 19th century imperialism is back. And of course, you know, which analogy you think with has implications about what you think will come out of this period. As I said, the 20th century analogy, it's scary because it makes us worry about the world war. At the same time, I think it's somewhat comforting because it tells us that after that period, a global international order will reemerge. And of course, 20th century in general is a good century for the West, right? So it's like we're going to go back to familiar ground after some turbulence. Again, the 19th century analogy, you know, it has its downsides, but it does, you know, if you're kind of a great power or in a kind of a powerful position, it's like, you know, imperial competition. Again, we know what that it's about. You know, the 19th century is not also somewhat comforting for that reason. Now, I'd like to suggest, and here I come more to Tuzo's side, or historian's side, that there are certain features of the 21st century, I think, that are not captured by international relational meeting of 19th and 20th centuries. So I will name three features, but there are more, obviously. But three, I think, kind of defining features of what's going on now that... And you're going to object, oh, these things existed before, but I have an answer. Don't object before you heard my argument. So one is this global trend of strongmen. We talk a lot about this. I mean, especially, you know, I mean, they are everywhere, right? Now they're in the West as well. You know, Trump-like figures, Putin, Orban, Erdogan, they're everywhere, on every continent. And And of course, you know, autocracies have always existed. But I think there's something new that is new or very old that is both happening with the current trend of strongman that is a bit different from autocracies or non-democracies. And I think what we're seeing is this culmination. I mean, again, this trend started earlier, but there's a trend toward, I would say, repersonalization or reprivatization of the state. The state, you know, modernity is a story of depersonalization, right? We're getting away from absolutist rulers, you know, the state institutions, the state is for the people. I think that trend has reversed. We can discuss when it started reversing, but I think we're now seeing state capture by individuals. You know, the so these strongmen that we have, they're not just autocrats of the 20th century versions, for who were still quite ideological. I mean, again, there were strongmen in the 20th century, but 21st century strongmen are, it's about them. You know, it's about their person, their, maybe their family. So that, I think, there are old theories which are very state-centric. I don't think account for that kind of development. The second thing I think that is true about the 21st century, that is not true about the 19th and 20th centuries, is that there's much more capacity everywhere, but especially in what the part of the world that we call the global south, which is always an inadequate term. But global south countries have more capability, you have more confidence. They are not just subjects to be acted on, but they are players in international politics. So I think all these reductive theories of just great power stuff, again, don't capture all the spoilers in the mix, right, that are making their own choices. I think that is, again, maybe a difference of degree, but I think it matters. The 21st century is more unpredictable as a result, because there are many more capable actors in world politics. Mm-hmm. Then, also, the structural pressures world politics are under have increased greatly, of a great magnitude. I mean, again, compared to the 20th century, climate change, of course, was present in the 20th century, but now, you know, its effects are becoming palpable. It's going to become even worse, with impact on, you know, supply chains and our ability to travel and all that. You know, how is that going to affect the connectivity of international order? Also, you know, technological changes. In Cambridge, we're relatively sheltered, but even we're not completely sheltered from the effects of AI and all of that. And how is that going to alter society very quickly? Again, quite hard to predict. And of course, financial volatility, financialization of, as they say, late stage capitalism. I mean, everybody's talking about, and this is unlinked to the previous point, you know, that we're in an AI bubble and it's going to burst soon. We're going to have another financial crisis. So all of that, I think, makes, so personalization and more actors running around, and then all these other structural pressures, all of that greatly, greatly increase the unpredictability of the system. We live through not unprecedented, but rather unpredictable times. So does that mean that there is no precedent for it? I think, again, depends on how you construct the analogy, but I personally prefer the 17th century as a potential analogy, and that comes out of my own work. I have a particular reading of what was happening in the 17th century. So let me just open a bracket in hopes of persuading you in 5 minutes that you should think about the 17th century in an entirely different way. Let me just mention what I argued in my previous book, which was called Before the West, In this book, I'm studying world, as I call it, world orders. They're not international orders because this is the time before, you know, nation states. World orders from 13th century to the 17th century, not in the West, but well, they are centered in Eurasia. And the argument is that the Mongol Empire brought back and innovated, again, I don't need to get into that, a particular understanding of sovereignty, a personalized form of sovereignty in the 13th century, and then kind of spread it across Asia. This particular understanding of sovereignty influenced Asian or Eastern politics for decades, centuries to come, because, you know, the Mongol Empire, like the Roman Empire, was commanded of the space that we call Asia. There were three successive, again, I'm happy to, you know, get into the book, but the book is not, you know, the talk is not about the book, but the book argues that there were three successive world orders organized by this particular understanding of sovereignty. And those world orders, and they account in the book, in my account in the book, and in the 17th century. And that's why I think potentially the 17th century is a good moment to compare with the present. So all of the orders I discuss in the book kind of end with periods of crises in the 14th century, 15th century, but those are like short periods of crisis. But in the 17th century, there is actually a very long period of crisis. And this is known to historians, and again, hotly debated in history. But this idea of a general crisis of the 17th century is a kind of a long-standing trope in history with specific application to European history. Trevor Roper, many people have written about it, you know, because, as you know, in European history, it's like the period of 30 Years' War and English Civil War, and all sorts of things are happening in Europe. But in recent years, there's now, you know, in an attempt to globalize the concept of the general crisis of the 17th century, and, you know, people have written about the rebellions in the Ottoman Empire, time of troubles in Moscow, and of course you have the Ming replacement downfall in China, another small crisis. So Northern Hemisphere, it's almost the end of the 16th century to the beginning of to the end of the 17th century. It's a period of disorder. And nowadays, the popular explanation is climate change. Why was this period so disorderly? Why do some historians think it was a period of general crisis? Because it was a time of climate change, but in the reverse direction. So the 17th century, and Jeffrey Parker was a military historian, has also written about this. The 17th century was the peak period of a longer, cool period known as the Little Ice Age. And the Northern Hemisphere was 2 to 3 Celsius degrees cooler, with like lots of unpredictable weather patterns and, you know, lots of art of people in cold conditions. Again, you can stay agnostic as to the relationship between climate change and political dysfunction or disorder. But the 17th century has climate change. You know, that part, you know, whether we want to call it general mess or not, it's a separate issue. But 17th century has climate change. It also has scientific revolution. So it's like rapid scientific advancement, change, innovations, and so on, which with, like, again, disruptive effects on society. It also has absolutist rulers. So this is the kind of, of course, you know, European age of absolutism. In my, if you take the account I provide in the book, that is actually, again, the tail end of a longer wave that's coming from Asia. It's a personalized sovereignty, Chinggis' sovereignty, as I call it, reaches Europe in 60th, 70th century. So I find that if we're looking for an analogy as to what's happening now in the 21st century, the 17th century potentially is a more interesting example to think with, or at least it gets us out of this complacency of, oh, we have a bit of volatility, and then order will quickly reemerge. And then forces us to confront this possibility of what happens if the world order, as it exists, fragments, because that's what happened in the 17th century to Asia. And then no order is reconstituted quickly. You know, it takes decades and decades for a new order to emerge, first regionally in Europe, then, you know, expand across the world. So I think that is potentially, a precedent for the times that we're in. Well, at least we should ask the question. When I give this talk, sometimes there's this was different, that was different in the 17th century. Obviously, many things were different. As I said, it's all about how we construct the comparison and the analogy. The reason why I think it's worth doing up, opening up our repertoire of potential comparisons for disorder beyond interwar years or end of the 19th century is because people can't help but think through analogies. And analogies direct us to particular endings. So the more analogies we have or more historical periods of comparison we have to think with, I think the more imaginative we can be about potential outcomes of that situation, not in a prescriptive way, but so that we don't get stuck in assuming things will unfold a particular way. So that's kind of my argument. That's, I think, what I want to. I'm writing this essay now, and if I'm very eager to hear your feedback as to whether that argument works or not, or if it doesn't, why it doesn't fit. This is the time to tell me. So thank you.